This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is Dr. Sharon Dunn. She's a return guest to the program, and Dr. Dunn is the Dean of the School of Allied Health Professions, Professor of Rehabilitation Sciences, and the Vice Chancellor of Academic Administration at Louisiana State University Health Shreveport. She graduated in 1987 with a BS in Physical Therapy from LSU, and a master's in health sciences in 1996, and she earned her PhD in cellular biology and anatomy in 2006, also from LSU Health Shreveport. Sharon's research interests include conservative clinical approaches to the management of common musculoskeletal conditions and translational research of applied mechanical loading to healing tissues to determine dosing effects and the ultimate functional and biomechanical tissue integrity. Dr. Dunn previously served on the PT faculty and as the program director, teaching professional issues, anatomy, biomechanics, and orthopedic physical therapy. Her clinical practice and board specialty is in the area of orthopedics. Throughout her career, Dr. Dunn has been professionally engaged in efforts to promote public policies to enhance the public's access to high-quality health services and excellence in practice delivery. She is the past president of the American Physical Therapy Association and has significant experience in health policy and collaborative approaches to health delivery. She advocates for a team-based approach and patient-centered management for both health, for better health outcomes in our communities. This is a great interview. Sharon is a return guest on this podcast, and in my opinion, one of the best leaders I've ever been around. It's a different interview, though, because we just don't talk specifically about physical therapy. We get into other things. We get into things, believe it or not, about how we feel about the way things are going in this country and the polarization that we feel. She got very vulnerable in this discussion. She was willing to share with us some of her deep feelings about incidences that have happened lately, and I just admire her so much for having the courage and the transparency to take us there. It's a great interview. As always, sitting around talking to Sharon is a complete pleasure. She is so intelligent, yet has so much emotional intelligence as well, and just somebody who's just fun to talk with. So I'm really excited to share this interview with you today. So sit back and enjoy a conversation with Dr. Sharon Dunn. Sharon, welcome to the program. It's so great to have you again today.
Thank you, Steve. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, you know, I was doing a little research, and you're one of only three people that I've ever had on this podcast the second time. And I went back and looked and actually listened to our interview, and that was almost 6 years ago.
That's hard to believe.
I just can't believe it. So you were the 19th episode, and I'm up around 175 now. So
I'm also honored that I'm one of three second interviews. So thanks for that.
Well, you're more than welcome. So let's just talk about your journey a little bit. You know, last time I talked to you, you were the president of the American Physical Therapy Association, and since then your term has been served, and so now you're no longer in that position, but you are in a high academic position now. So tell us what you're doing and what your title is.
Yeah, post-APTA leadership role, I dove headfirst into my day job at LSU Health Shreveport, and that is as the dean of the School of Allied Health Professions there. So we have six professional clinical programs within the school, and we have a master's degree in public health, and we have a PhD in rehab sciences. So there are 8 academic programs within the school. So that keeps me busy, but I'm also continually learning about health, health policy, and the direction of a multidisciplinary approach to giving people what they need and what they deserve along the health spectrum. So it has kept me busy and out of the current APTA leadership's hair. So I think it's been good for me and for APTA.
Yeah. Now, that's an amazing milestone. I mean, there are very few physical therapists that serve you know, that kind of a leadership in a university. I mean, I'm familiar with a couple others, but that's a pretty rare position for a PT to be in. So that's amazing.
Thank you. And I think we need a support group among higher ed leaders who are physical therapists. I've actually reached out to some of our PT colleagues to get information about strategic direction and budgeting and in general, the politics of higher education, and they are always willing to provide advice and counsel. So I do lean heavily on that network.
So in that role now, do you feel like you're less hands-on with students that are actually in the program and more in a leadership role with faculty of the university? How does that work?
Yeah, and I do miss that daily interaction with students, because you get it just like the daily interaction with patients. You get a lot of satisfaction in knowing that you made a difference for individuals. But it works that I support our administrative team, who then supports the administration of each of the individual programs, who support their faculty and support the students. So I believe in a flipped org chart. So I think administration is there to serve so that the people on the front lines can do their jobs well. And that's who I interact mostly with on a daily basis, or administrators who then serve the faculty. And then I also, because a dean role is middle management, I interact frequently with institutional administration as well.
Okay. And from a leadership perspective, you know, how is being the president of APTA different than being the dean of a university that you're currently in? I imagine those are very different roles, but they're both very high, strong leadership roles. So how are they different?
They're similar in many respects, and a lot I learned from APTA leadership that I engage and employ in my day job. But of course, APTA is a volunteer leadership role, and my job at LSU pays me. So there's somewhat of a difference there in what the expectations are. But at APTA, on the volunteer leadership side, you had APTA staff that implemented the direction of the volunteer leadership, and that is very different. I am the one in my day job that's responsible and accountable to make sure things are implemented and the vision and the leadership and the direction of the school. So, but what's beautiful about similarities is shared governance is what's part of both the academic environment and the APTA infrastructure. APTA shared governance was the board with the House of Delegates, with members and staff, and higher ed shared governance is administration works closely with faculty elected leadership to assure that there's shared governance and shared direction. And what's beautiful about that is when people are engaged in setting the direction, they then own it, and they're more engaged in assuring that it gets implemented. It's different than top-down leadership, that if in a top-down governance structure, the leader speaks it and expects and holds people accountable to implementation. So I think higher ed is run in many ways similar to the shared governance of APTA. So it was a natural translation of the skills and things that I learned through APTA leadership.
And I would imagine that the university, probably the focus or the emphasis strategically is, everybody's probably close to being on the same page, where APTA was such a diverse and large, things to consider that, you had to please a lot more diverse opinions and much more people in that APTA role.
Yeah, with 18 sections and 50 chapters, there was a lot of diversity of opinion and direction. Higher education is different because your mission is the education of the health professions of the future, but it's similar in that you got multi disciplines that with different needs and different objectives in their academic integration. So lots of similarities and lots of differences.
And you've seen a lot of different levels of leadership, and you've been in those roles yourself, and you witness a lot of others as well. So to you, what does great leadership look like?
Great leadership looks like a person that has a vision and a strategy that is mission-focused, mission-centric, and has the organization's best interest in mind, not individuals. However, that great leader engages and empowers the people that they lead to fulfill that direction. And so I see it as servant leadership. I think we talked about this 6 years ago.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
You can't lead unless you serve. You are called as a leader to serve those that you lead. And in serving those that you lead, you get messy. It's side-by-side work. It's assuring that the relationship is solid so that the person who's doing the work knows that they're valued. They know what their work contributes to the direction of the organization. And it's the leader's obligation to communicate that and empower individuals to make mistakes, because nobody is perfect. And if you're being innovative and creative in your role and in your job, you're going to make mistakes, and that's how people learn. So I don't think a great leader operates out of a fear-based structure. I think a great leader operates out of a service-based structure.
Yeah, that's well said. You know, in the 6 years that I've had, over 6 years that I've had this podcast, I've tried very hard not to get political. And so this next question, I don't want it to be political. I want to be it from a leadership perspective. But I know you to be a person who leans more on the conservative side of national politics. And then something happened that really made you question what happens with misdirected leadership and so on. So share with us today what went through your mind that day that we're talking about, and just kind of tell us what in the world you thought was going on.
Yeah, well, I have been throughout my life and throughout my voting history, I have voted on the Republican conservative side. I describe myself as a fiscal conservative and a social liberal. I believe that if you're talking about abortion, if you get the babies here, then you certainly need to provide the resources so that those babies can lead a strong and productive life. So the polarity in our politics that have been probably growing stronger over the last 6-8 years has concerned me, because I believe 80% of us are part of the 80% majority who are in the middle, who just want our government to work for the people. And the rancor that has been in the social media dialogue and the challenging situation that we find in our communities, where every election is contentious, it is bothersome to me, because I love our country and I want our country to be fiscally sound. Now we're in trillions of dollars of debt, and that's not good for any of us. It's certainly not good for the future. So as I watched what unfolded on January 6th, and unfolded in the days leading up to January 6th, I couldn't personally align with a party that allowed it to get that far. So on that day, as the attack on the Capitol happened on January 6th, I got on our Secretary of State's website and changed my party affiliation from R to D. And I didn't do that lightly. It took a lot of reflection and thought. And our Secretary of State is Kyle Ardoin. He's a Republican and a dear friend of mine, who was LPTA's lobbyist when I was president of the Louisiana Physical Therapy Association. So I figured, you know, I don't know whether the Secretary of State pays any attention to who flips their party affiliation, but I do know that they track those numbers. And I wanted to be a part of what could be a change. And I today do not vote according to party lines. When I go to vote, I vote on the individual's platform and their character and integrity. And that I don't look at the D or the R. I look at policy and platform and character and integrity when I vote. So that's a long answer to your question about what went through my mind on that day.
Well, it was a horrible day. I mean, just watching that and trying to believe that it's actually happening, and to the extent that, you know, it proceeded, and then to sit back and think it could have been 10 times worse too, with, you know, it was on the edge of being a complete disaster, and then, you know, for some it was a disaster. So it's just a hard thing to put your head around and realize that as a civilized country, we think we are sometimes, to have something like that happen was just shook all of us. I think it was just a horrible day in history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy then to see people then also try and defend it. I mean, you know, you could make the argument that, okay, things got out of hand, it wasn't handled right, people got crazy, and this is what happened. But then to then try and defend it, or to try and say, oh, they were just, patriots that were trying to, you know, exercise their freedoms and trying to save our country, I think is a really misguided, excuse for that as well.
I also think that's a response based on fear.
Yes.
We're talking about fear-based leadership, and I think these people who are working to defend it know where that base is, that voting base, and they're afraid if they don't, then their constituents are going to rail against them and cancel them. That's been, you've seen it happen on the media. And I applauded Bill Cassidy from Louisiana when he stuck to his guns, but he essentially got canceled in Louisiana. He'll never get elected to another statewide position again if he runs on the GOP ticket. And that's just the nature of our politics in Louisiana. He's fulfilling his term as senator, and I can usually count on him to just do the right thing. But it wasn't easy for him either, because he took a lot of heat from from one of the votes that he made after that. So I do believe that most people, most good people, know right from wrong, but if they've got a career in politics, they're afraid of standing up to this because of the dialogue that comes afterwards. So,
and it does.
I was also, you know, a couple of presidential speeches I made were from my heart as a Christian, and I, you know, after one of those speeches, a couple of my APTA colleagues who knew me to be a conservative came up afterwards and said, "Dr. Dunn, you appear to be leaning left these days." And I was like, I don't know where I'm leaning. I'm really confused where I'm leaning. But if you're talking about leaning left or right on a horizontal axis, I'm right in the middle. But if you're talking about right or wrong on a Christian perspective, I believe that I'm leaning that way because I look at the testimony of Christ and how he modeled servant leadership. That's my model. I'm not trained in leadership. I have never been in an academic or educational preparation on leadership. My training comes from the first four books of the New Testament, and that is modeling the behavior of Jesus Christ and how he loved people and led. He hated the sin, but he loved the sinner.
Yeah, and yet, you know, the evangelical churches and a lot of the organized religion in this country have supported, you know, leaders that are seem to me to be very unchristlike. So,
and that's where a lot of the conflict comes internally, and it's hard because that conflict is not only in our politics, but it's in our communities and even in our families, and that's the polarity and the challenges are very difficult to manage, and it's. I read a book, actually. Jason Bellamy sent me the book. It was written by Bob Welch, and the title of it is Cross Purposes. And it's exactly about what you just mentioned, is this challenge the evangelical church and Christianity faces with this dilemma that we have. And it was well written. And it resonated with me as a Christian trying to navigate today's political landscape. It's very challenging.
You know, I was at a concert once, and the singer-songwriter from Austin, Texas, was playing. This was a few years back, and about halfway through the concert, he just said, "You know, a lot of people say, should I sing for people on the left or people on the right?" And he goes, "I don't really care because we all love music. But if you're mean, yes, just get up and leave." That was a pretty good way to put it, you know. It's like, you know, we all have different opinions on politics and things that are important to us, which is healthy. It makes our country what it is. But if you're going to be mean, mm-hmm, and just cancel people and, you know, be outraged all the time and stuff, it makes it hard to work. I remember back in history, so you really admire people, you know, even if you don't agree with their politics. You know, I'm a history buff, and Daniel Webster, back in the day, wanted to be the president of the United States more than anything in the world, and he spent his whole career preparing for that. Yet when he took the stance on slavery, you know, he knew that he would never get elected, but yet he still took that stance, and he went together with Henry Clay, you know, and they just said, you know, this isn't right, and we need to kind of stick up to it. So he gave up his chance to be president. And you look at, you know, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and your senator and so on that feel like they, mm-hmm, do the right thing, and then they get punished. It's just, it's a crazy deal.
Yeah, and Liz Cheney has taken a lot of heat for pursuing what she believes is right. And she was unelected, and she continues to communicate in a very clear and concise way what she believes is constitutional and right for the future of the country. And you got to admire people who are willing to sacrifice what they've worked for their whole lives for what they believe is the right thing to do for the organization, if we're back to leadership of organizations or the country in this respect. And, you know, God bless America, because we were founded on the principles of democracy and people, that we the people leading the future of the country. We're still a very nascent experiment in that. And I pray for us to find the right direction.
Yeah, that's what's scary, for sure. So you said it, you know, earlier that, you know, this is people are doing things or leading their constituents out of fear. You know, when you look back on your positions in leadership, you know, can you imagine leading with that fear of losing your job every day? I would think that would be almost impossible, wouldn't it?
It is. It's impossible to be bold when you're watching your back all the time. And if you can't be courageous and bold, you can't make a difference, honestly. Status quo is the norm in a fear-based environment, or you regress. And so, been in that position. And it's untenable.
Yeah, I can remember a politician making a statement once that on a very kind of controversial issue, and his quote was, "Well, if we do what's right, then no one will be happy." You know, I thought it was
exactly
a good point, because, you know, the right's not going to get their way, the left's not going to get the way, and, you know, so somebody's always going to be unhappy, but yet, you know, you can't make everybody happy, and you can't give everybody what they want, because sometimes they just want the wrong things.
Right. And it's the difference between organizational health and individual health. I mean, what's good for the individual sometimes is not the best for the organization. So when your obligation is to the organization, you make decisions that are best for the whole. And you can never make everyone happy. There will be unhappy people if they don't. But that's just a fact of life and a part of leadership.
Well, you know, as you know, I was the CEO of a large company, and it had a varied and shared ownership structure. And, you know, every once in a while you'd get somebody in there that was, you know, too me, you know, well, this doesn't help me and this doesn't benefit me, so why would I do that and whatever. And so there has to be a certain amount of a group dynamic there that, okay, I can see that this may not benefit me, but if it benefits the whole, you know, it takes a good leader to see that and to be willing mm-hmm. to go down that path.
Mm-hmm. And I believe people who are self-centered don't make great leaders, because they can't see beyond themselves to the health of the organization. Usually what's great for me is not great for the whole. It has to be good for the whole organization. And many times individual priorities are at conflict with organizational priorities. And if you're all about yourself, then you probably should reconsider whether or not you're a leader.
Absolutely. You know, given this polarization in our nation today with politics and whatever, do you have hope? I mean, do you think we're going to get through this? Do you think it's a blip in the historical, you know, line of this country, or are we in trouble?
I have hope, because I just believe in the power of democracy. I believe in the power of an engaged and empowered republic. And does the number of people who vote right now concern me? Absolutely. I don't think we have mobilized the we the people enough. We had a sheriff election here in Caddo Parish just this last election cycle that came down to one vote. So if you don't think your vote matters,
wow,
it does. Yeah. One vote. And they did a recount, and each candidate got three additional votes, and it still came down to one vote. So voting matters, and I think the generations that are coming up should recognize their power in the vote. And they should all see that the fact that we have a democracy and the people's voice directs the future of this country, that's where my hope is. And if our voting numbers don't pick up, then I am concerned. So my advice is everyone use your voice and your power at the polls.
Yeah, it's going to be a wild 11 months, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Well, thanks for going down that that path with me. I know that's not easy to do on a podcast that a lot of people with a lot of diverse opinions might listen to, but I think we need to have these discussions. I think we need to just kind of talk about it and think about it and not go out and accuse people or condemn people or cancel people. It's just let's have some discussion.
Civil discussion, civil debate is challenged right now, and I think wiser, kinder conversations will, you know, some of my favorite times in APTA were when Florence Kendall and Shirley Sarmon would go after each other for what they really believed related to posture and muscle tone, and then they had this huge mutual respect for one another. And so that took precedent. So every time they would debate the issue, they would laugh and poke fun and leave those conversations with, hey, we just had a great academic discussion, but our respect for each other takes precedent over that. And I think human respect and mutual respect is important for us to get over a lot of this. And I don't expect everyone to agree with me. I just would love to have an academic conversation that where we can appreciate each other's views. And if we have to agree to disagree, great. But we learn when we have these conversations, and I'm open-minded. I can come to another decision with additional information, and I hope everyone stays that way.
And you got to be willing to learn, you know, learn something mm-hmm. new, learn a different perspective. You know, how cool is it when you feel so strong about something and then you hear another side of it and you kind of step back and say, man, I never looked at it from that way before. I may not change my mind, you know, about mm-hmm. the exact issue we're talking about, but I certainly have a different perspective, and I can certainly see why you come from it from that place.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at, you know, we all have good friends. In fact, some of the best friends are the ones that we do disagree about stuff, but we're able to talk about it. You know, it's like, you know, call them out and say, I can't believe you said that, or do you really think that? And you have a discussion. And again, at the end of the day, as you said, you may not change that person over to your way of thinking on that particular subject, but at least you could talk about it. And then if you walk away still liking each other, that's a pretty strong friendship.
Yes. There's nothing I like more than being challenged by someone I trust. And usually the challenge is going to make me grow. And that's what it's all about. I grow as a person. My perspective changes. I've learned something about myself that needs to be moderated or adapted. And that makes me better.
Hallelujah. Now, maybe you're the one that needs to run for office from the state of Louisiana, right?
I don't know. I don't know, Steve. I'm a moderate. So moderates don't stand a chance these days.
But it's
however, we just had a Democratic governor who believed in the right to bear arms and was also anti-abortion. So John Bel Edwards was probably more of a Republican than he was a Democrat, but he was a registered Democrat and won the governor's position for two straight terms. So he won as a moderate. And the state has done really well under his leadership.
Well, we need more moderates.
That was 8 years ago. Yeah. 8 years ago when he came in.
So. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So let's switch gears here a little bit. Let's talk about, let's stay on our theme of leadership. That's what this podcast is about. And I heard a story recently that I'd like you to share with us about your brother, who's a football coach, and how he coached a decade or two ago and how he coaches now. Could you share with us kind of what you observed and what you've said before in that in relation to that?
Yeah, my big brother, he's 3 years older than me, and he's one of the best leaders I know because he's always learning. He's always hungry. And he's always looking to learn and adapt his style. And what I shared at a couple of conferences that were about leadership was his story. He was the youngest head football coach in Louisiana High School Athletic Association history when he became a head coach at the age of 25. At our alma mater, which was a 4A high school, and he was fiery. He would meet his quarterback on the hash mark of the field and grab their face mask and pull them into. He's not very tall, so he would usually be pulling them down to where they were eyeball to eyeball, and he could give that quarterback, you know, a learning opportunity right there after after the bad play. And he was incredibly, insanely successful with that method of coaching. He won 9 or 10 state championships at three different levels, from 1A to 3A to 5A, and with that style of very fiery, when you think of that style, it's kind of like a Nick Saban kind of fiery, inspired coaching. And then he had the opportunity to go to college, and he coached at a Division III college in Central Louisiana for about 10 years. He took their football program into competing for conference championships at the time with similar methods. And then he went back into high school. And when he went back into high school, he had a couple of mediocre seasons. And he's not a good loser. No strong leader is a good loser.
Yeah.
And so he had, you know, a 4-6 or a 5-5 season. And he's like, Sharon, you know, maybe I'm getting too old for this. Maybe I need to hang it up. But these kids are soft. And so he's like, they don't take to my methods of coaching anymore. And so after, you know, some introspection and reflection on the generation coming up, he started inviting these kids to his and his wife's house for leadership development, and he started learning what motivates and inspires this generation coming up. And it's to feel valued and to feel honored, and love essentially is the answer. And so his harshness became kindness. His strength in how he used to inspire became strength in love and guidance and mentoring. And his teams now set team goals. He doesn't interfere with that. This millennial generation likes to be part of the planning for things that impact them. So he's nowhere near ready to retire now, because he plays tonight in the semifinal game. If we win tonight, we'll be going to the Dome next week for the state championship game.
Wow.
And he told me, he said, "Sharon, you know, the leader's job is to adjust and adapt to those they lead. And the leader can't expect those they lead to adjust and adapt to the leader, because if you want the product through the people who are implementing the product, that's who should be in charge of directing the leader in how to lead them, how to guide them, how to love them, how to serve them." So I've learned a lot about leadership just from watching my brother and how successful he's been in coaching. And man, it's fun to see him have this much fun again.
Yeah, that's
having a ball.
What a great story. It reminds me that my wife Sharon and I, when we started having kids, you know, we thought we knew how to be parents, but we weren't totally sure. So we took some parenting classes, and it was very, very eye opening, and learned a lot of strategies. And I always remember what the instructor said. He said, "Now, all of you at the age you are, I can probably predict that you're brought up in a very authoritarian family. You know, yes. You never questioned your dad. You did what he said to do. And if you didn't, you're in big trouble," and, you know, whatever. And he says, "But you can't be successful going forward with kids today with that strategy that you grew up. It has to be different. It's got to be mm-hmm. in a different way." And I always remember that, because it parallels your story. It's, you know, just because that's the way I did it when I was younger, that's how I learned. You have to change with the times. It doesn't make you soft. It doesn't make you weak. It just means that you listen. And there's more than one right answer to the question. There's more than, you know, the path is a crooked line, you know. So I think that's a great lesson to think about.
And you probably, if you have more than one kid, you realize that those two kids didn't react the same to the same kind of parental guidance either.
I have three, and they all have very different personalities, and it's like, it's crazy to think about. They have the same genes, but they're very, very different, and they respond to, you know, as a parent, just like as a leader, how I would talk to one, you know, in a instructive way, may be very different than the other, because mm-hmm. you can't teach everybody the same way. You can't treat everybody the same way.
No. Okay. It's people are unique, and they respond to unique situations in unique ways. So it's the leader's obligation to adapt to that, not the team members.
I always remember, again, relating to that, in my days playing football in high school. And I guess I started this feeling about this early, because I can remember at the end of practice, the coach, who was kind of that old school, you know, command and control and yell and scream and whatever, at the end of practice, he'd always say, "Okay, everybody run around the goalpost twice for conditioning. And the last three guys have to run a third time." And I always thought, that is so unfair, because you knew who the last three guys were. They were the 280, 300-pound linemen, and all the backs and ends were, you know, dinking around and, you know, goosing each other when they ran around, because it was easy for them. And those guys always had to run again. And I remember I actually got enough courage once to say, that's not fair. you know, to those guys. And the coach said, well, they need it more than everybody else. But, you know, you just
look. Well, no, they really need to, they really didn't need to run because that's not their job on the field.
Exactly.
They need to block and tackle more.
Exactly. So anyway, it's just interesting to think back on the things that we learned. And again, you know, people ask me, why do I do this podcast at this stage of my career and whatever? It's because every time I do one, I learn something. So, you know, you're never too old to learn. You're never too old to maybe change an approach on how you do things. There's so much to enjoy in life if you can not fight things that are not worth fighting.
Yeah. And put people in their natural giftings.
Yeah.
And their natural skill sets, and then watch them succeed. I heard something one time, and I'm going to botch this quote, but if you've got a squirrel on your team, don't try to make them swim. I mean, put them in a tree and let them climb.
Yeah.
If you got a fish on your team, don't make them climb a tree. Put them in the water and let them swim.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for that, is looking for your people's natural skill sets and giftings. And turn them loose to excel in what they were naturally gifted to do.
Yeah.
Then you look good.
Exactly. And I think, again, from my generation, I think that it was definitely treat everybody the same, do everything the same way. And then, you know, it just, it doesn't work. You know, I mean, it works for some. You think back on all the, you know, I've heard people make the comment, well, look at how great a coach Bobby Knight was, and look at the success he had. And my thought would always go to, yeah, but for every success that became an NBA player or whatever, how many guys did he ruin?
By throwing chairs.
Tantrums. Yeah, so, yeah, he had success, but at what cost? You know, sometimes I think you have to look at that end of it, too. So.
Yeah.
So tell us in your role now, how you mentor, coach, and sponsor, especially women, but men as well, emerging leaders coming through your organization and people that you come in contact with. How do you look at that, and what are you trying to do?
What we were just talking about comes to mind is knowing your people. And knowing those who are truly serving the organization and not themselves, and then looking at what their natural giftings and skill sets are. And many times you put them in a situation that they believe is beyond their skill set. But then when you see them rise above that and conquer it, their confidence just explodes. They become more confident in their own skills, so they begin to tackle bigger and bigger tasks. So and I don't believe that it is necessarily educational training, but you have to be prepared for the job that you have, but it's experience too. And so what I like to do is give people opportunities to succeed beyond what they believe they can do. And that inspires them, and it encourages them, and it gives them confidence to take on additional risks in the workplace that move the organization forward. So I love to see new leaders take on roles, and I love to be there when they fail and to share my experiences with failure so they don't lose confidence, but they learn from those failures and grow. I love to sponsor people. You use the word, and mentoring is one thing, but sponsoring is another. I've got a young lady on our administrative team that when she joined us as business manager of the school, she just was really skilled. She had two master's degrees, one in health administration and one in business administration. And she came in and just overhauled our whole financial system for the school. And I told her after about 6 months of working with her, I said, you are going to outgrow the School of Allied Health Professions. I said, and I want to mentor you here, but I also want to sponsor you so that you have opportunities beyond this, because you are going to grow beyond this. I will never try to keep you down. If you want to grow beyond here, I want to be involved in helping you go. And that's hard because you spend some time mentoring and guiding, investing in, you certainly want to keep them, but that restricts them. So when people know that you want to sponsor them and then that you're their advocate, that's great opportunity for them to go and show what they learned under your guidance somewhere else.
Right. And what makes that sponsor part so hard for some people is you are risking your reputation and, what other people think of you if you sponsor that person, say, this is somebody who I think's the bomb, you know, and then, mm-hmm. and because if they aren't, that comes back on you. So that's a big step. Yes. It's pretty easy to mentor and coach people, but to sponsor people is mm-hmm. a whole different level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a risk, but it certainly is worth it. When, I think of people like Lynn Snyder-Mackler in our profession, who was a female PhD mentor to so many of our greatest scientists right now. And the people she has mentored there at the University of Delaware have gone on with outstanding research careers. Jennifer Stevens Lapsley is one of those people. And would it have been great for Jennifer to stay there at University of Delaware and help at that institution? Yes, but the research community likes when their protege goes out and spreads their wings because it makes that sponsorship look really good. And it's fun to watch mentors and sponsors love on their protégés and mentees across the country, and that work just exponentially grows. And I love to see that kind of leadership.
You know, in an episode I released just this week from this podcast, I was interviewing a woman who is heading the Women's Leadership Division at the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern University. And she said, you know, you always hesitate to make generalizations, but one thing that she thinks is something worth understanding as a leader is that men, you know, probably because the way we were brought up as boys, if there's 10 criteria that that you need for this job, if a man thinks they got 5 or 6, they'll go for it and say, I'll figure out the rest. Mm-hmm. Where a woman will often want 8 or 9 or 10 of them and make sure they're ready to go in that way. So to sponsor somebody who's only got the 5 or 6, but, you know, wants to push them forward so that the experience can get them to the 8 or 9 or 10. Is a really important step, I think, in developing leaders.
And I've shared that those statistics as well, that women typically won't raise their hand unless they meet all of the required competencies. And many times, you know, there's usually in a job description, there's required and preferred, and you have to meet the required, but preferred you don't have to meet. But women will typically look at that preferred list and say, well, I don't meet that, so I'm not applying. But men will, okay, I meet that and some of the preferred. So yes, I'm looking for that next opportunity. And so it's interesting the differences that we have.
You know, in anticipation of our discussion today, is there anything that I haven't asked you or we haven't touched on that you want to be sure and get into the program today?
No, we went pretty deep on some topics.
We took some risks, which is great. Right?
I was very vulnerable and probably ought to say that I no longer represent the voice or opinion of APTA. in the things that I shared today, because I am no longer the president, but I kind of feel free that I can express Sharon Dunn's opinion and not those of my employer or that of APTA.
Yeah, amen to that. That's great. So, Sharon, as you know, I always ask my guests the same common question. So, at the end of the interview here, so in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom you'd like to leave us with today?
It's probably similar to the last time. It's to serve others. Your greatest opportunity in life comes when you serve the needs of someone that can't do for themselves what you can do for them. And so serving others is probably one of the biggest gifts I've ever had in my life, the ability to do that.
Well, Sharon, this has been a complete pleasure. You know, you think in your life when you look at things you enjoy, and it's always enjoyable to sit around with somebody and have deep discussions and really pick someone's brain. And, you know, I've always enjoyed doing that with you. It's, you know, we need to spend some time around some campfires and continue that discussion. So I just want to thank you for being vulnerable today, going deep, as you mentioned. And, you know, from my perspective, I just want everyone listening to know that I think that you are one of the greatest leaders I've ever witnessed. You really
thank
are.
You.
Because you,
thank you,
you do all the things you say, and you back it up, and everyone feels it. You know, like you say, it's not always what you say, it's what people feel. And people feel that you care about them, and they feel that you're... that your vision is for the greater good. And so for that, I commend you and I admire you, and you're at the top of my list.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, and appreciate what you've done for the profession and for private practice, and bringing in voices that we can all learn from. Really appreciate that. You know, that one of my assignments to a course in professional issues is for them to listen to 3 of your podcasts and then report back what they've learned from not necessarily people within the profession of PT, but other leaders. So that always kind of keeps me up on what you're doing.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. Well, have a great holiday season with those you love and all your staff and all the people you work with. And I look forward to seeing you somewhere down the road.
Thank you. Can't wait. Appreciate you.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.